You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Mr. Weber's Confession by Nancy Jo Sales. Do you find it ironic that in this situation my voice was not consulted by you, I ask? I disagree that your voice wasn't consulted by the Academy, said McKendall. The next day, I mailed a letter to Weber at his home in New Hampshire. After talking to the lawyers, I was more doubtful than ever that he had actually confessed. None of it made sense to me. I tried to make this letter as brief and spare as possible, so as not to confuse him. I'd started to wonder if he'd possibly become confused in his old age. I told him that I was not the one who had made the accusation against him, that I had denied this accusation, and that I'd like to talk to him about it. Within a few days, he emailed me back at the address I'd given, saying, "Of course I'm willing to talk with you." If the school had treated this case as a misdemeanor, so to speak, and without duplicity, Weber wrote, I would have entirely moved on by now. Since they have proceeded as they have, I've only partly moved on. I'm still angry. I called him at his home on June 7th, 2021. I was nervous as the phone rang. The situation was so awkward. But as soon as I heard his voice, I felt more comfortable, recognizing the person I knew. He sounded the same almost 40 years later. You say you're angry about this. So am I told him. I don't like the way I was treated. I asked him to tell me the story of what happened from his side. Weber said that for him, it all started in 2017, when he was questioned by Catanzano in connection with Cecilia Morgan's complaint to Exeter about Richard Schubert. They were investigating whether there had been failures to report, he said. What I told them was I had no recollection of such a conversation with Cecilia's sister Maria, but in general, I thought Maria was a reliable person. So if she said there was a conversation, there must have been a conversation, but not one in which I understood there was a reporting obligation. After concluding their investigation, Weber said, Exeter officials told him, we've decided that you didn't do anything actionable, and I had been essentially completely exonerated. Weber said he didn't have any further dealings with the school's lawyers until late September 2020, when he got a call from Barcroft. She said, we have received a complaint that accuses you of having had an inappropriate relationship with a former student. Weber said Barcroft never told him any details of this allegation, although she did make clear the accusation was coming from a third party. A spokesperson for the school denies this, saying, Ms. Barcroft simply informed David Weber that Holland and Knight would like him to submit to an additional interview in light of new information received. Barcroft's call to Weber came weeks after I had denied the allegation to Palmer, Rawson, and the Exeter police. But Barcroft did not inform Weber of any of this, he said. He wasn't aware of my denials until he got my letter. And then, in October 2020, he had his interview with Catanzano over Zoom. So, did you tell him anything happened? I asked. I told him that we kissed, he said. I was stunned. Why did you do that? I asked. Because we did, he said. I'm surprised that you remember that differently. I had imagined that Weber would have some other explanation, that he felt pressured, or cornered, or rattled, that he had thought that by saying he had kissed me, he was somehow pleading to a lesser charge than a sexual relationship, for which there might even be legal repercussions. Anything but this casual assertion of something of which I had no memory. I have no recollection of that at all, I told him. Are you sure you remember me? He laughed and said, yes, I do. Do you have any signs of memory loss or dementia or anything, I ask? Or could you be confusing me with another person? He said, no. So you told him this because you thought it happened? Correct, he said. Okay, I said. Well, I'm telling you it never happened. Okay, Weber said. I'm convinced that it did happen, although I'm also convinced and have always said that there was no sexual dimension to it. I was trying to understand him. I suddenly had a different memory, a memory of something I don't think I ever would have remembered but for this conversation. It was of a different English teacher, a burly fellow, who, at graduation, hugged me so hard it knocked the wind out of me. I remembered how my older brother, who'd been standing there, had later asked, "What was that?" And I told him, "Oh, he's just very intense." "So, you're saying we kissed, but there was nothing sexual about it?" I asked Weber. "Correct," he said. I felt that I had arrived at another absurd impasse in this situation. Weber and I sort of tacitly agreed to disagree on our memories of each other. Then we started speculating about why the Academy would have come down so hard on him for an incident that I said never happened and he said was not sexual. "As far as I can tell," Weber said, "they're proceeding in the way they are because they were humiliated by the whole Schubart thing and the way it assimilated Exeter into the larger New England prep school narrative of decades-long sexual abuse of students, especially by faculty. Now their focus is on extricating themselves from that narrative and demonstrating that they're no longer like that, and they have zero tolerance for any kind of boundary violation." I was thinking of M. Weber and I spoke again a couple of weeks later with his lawyer, Russell Hilliard, on the phone. I wanted to hear more about what had happened when Weber was interviewed about me by Holland and Knight, and his lawyer had offered to be on this call. On the call, Weber also shared that some of his fellow teachers and former students had expressed support for him and reached out to Rawson to express their dismay at the hugging and kissing email. Weber was troubled, he said, at seeing some of the posts on the Exonian's Facebook page that had appeared after the email had landed, comments which characterized him as a predator of abusing an adolescent. The page is public. When people posted positive comments about him, he was someone I trusted implicitly, for example. They were challenged by those who insisted that they had a moral obligation to examine those memories in light of new information. These defenders of victims said that expressing any positive memories of Weber was offensive to even a form of violence against all victims. This was a strange and unsettling thing for me to read, as I was the alleged victim in this case, and I knew that no abuse had happened. I think some of the firestorm on Facebook was people thinking there must have been more to Rawson's email than it said, Weber speculated. Otherwise, the Academy wouldn't have acted in such an extreme way, delivering the same punishment to him that it had handed down to Cecilia Morgan's abuser, Richard Schubart. Weber said the first draft of Rawson's email had actually said that he had admitted to sexual misconduct. But Weber and Hilliard had protested this language, saying that it was false and defamatory, after which Exeter amended it to say that Weber had admitted to hugging and kissing a student. However, the beginning of the missive still said it brought news of sexual misconduct. When Weber confessed to the alleged hugging and kissing incident in his interview with Catanzano, it was actually around the same time as the conversation I had with Rawson, in which he gave me no indication that this investigation was moving forward. After he confessed, Weber said, the conversation became very explicit on an anatomical level. What? Really? I said. Oh, my God. Catanzano wanted to know precisely what things came into contact, Hilliard offered. My heart sped up. It angered me that even after my denials about an alleged sexual relationship, there had been a lawyer interrogating Weber about what contact he had allegedly made with my then 17-year-old body. I'm just disgusted, I said, my voice getting louder. It's not right of him to discuss my body with another person in this context. Do you understand how I feel? I wasn't sure if the men did understand. Weber almost defended Catanzano in this regard, saying, yes, but he's been asked to investigate my behavior. I felt that I had to make it clear to them that to me, this line of questioning was outrageous. You're men, I said, so you haven't grown up in a world in which your body is constantly being commented upon and talked about. It's infuriating for a lot of women to think that here is a man asking another man about her body, my body, and he's talking about my body even after I said this conversation should be over. I was upset. I could tell that the men didn't really get why. But how could they understand completely? They didn't know about my sexual assault. They couldn't see how, for me, this was all wrapped up in my feelings about once having been robbed of my consent. After a moment, Hilliard said, I'm distressed that they weren't honest with us about what had been alleged or not alleged or denied. That's the inexplicable part to me. When they have your uncategorical denial in conjunction with some anonymous third-party report, and don't share that with David and me, the only explanation is that it's not appropriate. What it says to me is they privileged the accusation over your denial, said Weber. Why in the world did they pursue this? Asked Hilliard. I was hoping just to get Morgan's reaction to what I'd learned about alleged sexual assaults at Exeter in the present day when I called her in July. Over email, Morgan had agreed to talk to me. We had never spoken before. We hadn't known each other at Exeter except in passing. The conversation started with her telling me that, in anticipation of our call, she had looked up her agreement with Exeter. In 2015, she received an undisclosed settlement from the school. She said that in her talks with Exeter, school officials had promised her they would create a system that would be available to students to talk about or report any possible sexual abuse, and that there would be some kind of training for the adults, the staff, to prevent it. It was a big concern of mine that sexual abuse be prevented, she added, saying that her worries were related to her experience with Schubert. Mr. Weber knew about it, she said. I hadn't brought up Weber's name. Morgan mentioned him first. Then she told me something I didn't know, something that hasn't been made clear in news reports about her case, nor does Weber seem to remember it himself. She said that when we were students at Exeter, she had actually told her sister, Maria, to tell Weber not to report Schubert. Mr. Weber said to Maria, "Do you want me to report this?" Morgan said, and Maria asked me, and I said no. And so he didn't, which, in retrospect, I don't think was the appropriate approach. I was protective of Mr. Schubart and our relationship, but Mr. Weber should have reported Mr. Schubart. Mr. Schubart should have been turned in. Quite frankly, Mr. Weber has ruined my life, Morgan said. I mean, if he had turned Mr. Schubart in, and I had been acknowledged and all of that stuff before I went off to college, before I went off into the world. I recognized in her voice the pain that sexual assault victims carry with them throughout our lives. I hate Mr. Weber, Morgan said, repeating. Mr. Weber never turned Mr. Schubart in. I told her that I decided to do this story because I'd been contacted by Christina Palmer, who had called me up out of the blue and asked if I had had a sexual relationship with Weber when I was at Exeter. I said I didn't know who had made the allegation, which was false. They won't tell me who it is, I said. There was a pause. Then after a bit, Morgan said, You may want to hang up on me when I'm done telling you this. A couple of years after we graduated from Exeter, around 1984, a friend of mine told me that you were having a sexual relationship with Mr. Weber. She found this out. She found this out? How? I asked. I don't know, said Morgan. She and I were good friends, and she knew about what had happened with Mr. Schubart. She said that she had heard this. She'd heard it from whom? I asked. I don't know, said Morgan. I have no idea. I wonder if she's the person who reported this, I mused. No, I am, said Morgan, because I was so pissed. Oh, you reported it? I was so shocked by this revelation. It took me a moment to understand what she was saying. Because I was very upset that Mr. Weber didn't turn Mr. Schubart in, Morgan explained. The fact that if Weber had been having a relationship, or whatever you want to call it, with a student at the same time, then of course he was not going to turn Mr. Schubart in. This whole culture of, let's just have sex with students and we all get away with it. Do they have any idea how devastating it is to the student? She went on. It was very upsetting. This culture of men effing around with girls, taking advantage of them. I was just so upset about it. So I just said, would you please talk to her? Meaning me. I can tell you I'm upset right now, I said after a moment. My body feels bad right now. I'm so sorry, Morgan said. But why, I asked, after all these years, had she decided to make this allegation? She said it was after she'd received an email from Rawson that went out to the Exeter community promising the school was doing everything it could to deal with sexual misconduct. In an email dated August 24, 2020, Rawson announced that criminal charges had been filed against Czesny Jerzy Kaminski for multiple counts of sexual assault involving a former Exeter student. The principal further encouraged alumni to report sexual misconduct, saying, "We remain committed to investigating any allegations." Searching her emails as we spoke, Morgan said she found the one she said she sent to Christina Palmer on August 24, 2020, concerning her allegation about Weber and me. She said she'd also exchanged emails about this with Holly Barcroft around the same time. I never had any contact with Rawson, she said. I asked her why she didn't simply reach out to me and say, look, I heard this. Is it true? Would you like to report this? Why didn't you come to me? Well, I don't know, she said. I wish I had, because it never occurred to me. I guess because I was focused on David Weber. I apologize. Why didn't I? Because maybe I thought you would say, what the F are you talking about? It's none of your business. And if I had said that, wouldn't that be my right? I asked. I told her about my experiences talking with Palmer, Rawson, the lawyers at Holland and Knight, and Weber. I felt like I was being treated like a liar by everyone, I said. I felt like no one believed me, and that was upsetting too, because it made me think about how victims are not believed. Clearly, I screwed up, Morgan said. I'm not sure this makes it any better for you, but I didn't know they would upset you. I just thought they would ask you and you would either say yes or no. I honestly just wanted them to talk to Mr. Weber. I told her how all this made more sense to me now. The decision by the school to punish Weber despite my denials, now that I knew it was she who had made the allegation. Why? Said Morgan. I didn't know I had that much sway at Exeter. They might have wanted to make sure you were satisfied with how they dealt with this case because Weber failed to report your situation, I said. They might have also thought, like you did, that Weber must have been having a sexual relationship with a student, and that's why he didn't report your case. His failure to report caused them a lot of problems. Morgan sighed. I didn't want him to be punished, she said after a while. I wanted the academy to deal with their system that covers up the abuse of girls. I wanted them to put a system in place where teachers are compelled to report. I want the school to do the right thing because I know how traumatizing it is to have this happen, and I want it to stop. We're on the same page, and I totally support you in that, I said. We have a lot in common. Our lives are parallel in a lot of ways. So I get you, and I'm not mad at you. I understand why you did what you did. I understand all of the emotions behind it, I think. The last thing I would want to do is hurt another victim, and I am so ambivalent about Exeter and a lot of stuff, Morgan said. We were silent a moment, and then she said, I really actually don't give a shit about Exeter. We laughed. And then we decided that the next time we're in each other's city, we're going to get together for a beer. A couple of weeks later, I got an email from Rawson, responded to the many questions I had for him, Palmer, and the school's lawyers about this whole situation. Rawson seemed convinced that Exeter had handled everything correctly. My colleagues and I believe we have followed the thoughtfully conceived protocols for investigating and disclosing sexual misconduct in the Weber matter, he wrote. Because Mr. Weber admitted, with his attorney present, to engaging in conduct with a student that unquestionably constituted sexual misconduct, there was no other choice of action. But, he added, that does not keep us from sincerely regretting the harm you have experienced in that process. Roast the Runway. Diet Prada turned its relatively unknown founders into two of fashion's most powerful voices. Ethicist, keeping tabs on industry wrongs. But now, the front row's most feared Instagram account is facing mounting scrutiny from their peers and a $700 million lawsuit from a luxury titan. By Maureen O'Connor, with opening illustration of attendees at a runway show by Jorge Arevalo. The sky was overcast on November 21, 2018, and a light drizzle fell on the Shanghai World Expo Exhibition and Convention Center as the Italian luxury brand Dolce & Gabbana put the finishing touches on an event space twice the size of the Royal Palace of Milan. There were winding banquettes draped in red, littered with candelabras and flowers for the reception. There was an 80-foot rotating stage, three gold catwalks, and sets decorated with gold Italianate mirrors, Juliet balconies, and red upholstered settees with carved feet. The brand's founders, Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana, had designed a new collection for the occasion, an all-night fashion extravaganza dubbed the Great Show. The production aimed to blend Dolce's signature Molto Italiano style with Chinese heritage. There was a pagoda with a gold roof in the lobby, and troupes who would perform traditional lion and dragon dances. Festivities would run well into the night. More than 300 models were to walk before an estimated audience of 1,500. But the show's carefully laid plans had begun to unravel. To promote the event on social media, Dolce & Gabbana had produced videos of a Chinese model struggling to eat Italian food with chopsticks. Off camera, a male voice teased her. "Let's use these small stick-like things to eat our great pizza margherita," the narrator said, as the model giggled and covered her face. "It's still way too big for you, isn't it?" he said, as she battled an oversized cannolo. When Dolce & Gabbana posted the videos 3 days before the show, Chinese internet users complained about outdated views of China and racism. On November 19th, Jing Daily, a luxury consumer trends website, reported that Boycott Dolce had been discussed on Weibo more than 18,000 times. Halfway around the world, in Brooklyn, then 33-year-old Tony Liu saw the videos and posted them to Diet Prada, the Instagram account he runs with fellow fashion industry insider Lindsay Schuyler. "Being Asian, there were certain things that immediately triggered me," he has since recalled. Diet Prada's caption characterized the video as hella offensive and a tired and false stereotype of a people lacking refinement. Diet Prada had roughly 1 million followers at the time. One of them, Michaela Tranova, then a 24-year-old Londoner who worked in fashion, shared the post and commented in part, "What in the actual F?" That's when the shit hit the fan. Or, more accurately, the shit emojis hit the DMs. Gabbana's verified personal Instagram account responded. Tranova had never before interacted with a designer on or offline, but the two fell into a heated exchange. Tranova received messages about Chinese people eating dogs and insulting her intelligence. When Tranova noted that some of Dolce & Gabbana's social media accounts had deleted the cannolo video, "At Stefano Gabbana said this happened because my office is stupid as the superiority of the Chinese." While Dolce & Gabbana initially issued a statement that then 55-year-old Gabbana's account had been hacked, In subsequent court filings, Gabbana's lawyers identified the messages as Mr. Stefano Gabbana's private conversations. And from now on, in all the interviews that I will do international, I will say that the country of, and here he uses five poop emojis, is China, read one at Stefano Gabbana message. China, ignorant, dirty-smelling mafia, read another. Trinova was outraged. She posted screenshots of the exchanges and tagged several media outlets, including Diet Prada. Gabbana's lawyers would later say, Mr. Stefano Gabbana answered a few provocations using ironic tones, including toward the Chinese people. On November 20th, the day before the great show, Liu posted several of Trinova's incendiary screenshots to Diet Prada, and the simmering controversy boiled over into scandal. Models and staff fled the convention center, leaving their hand-tailored garments in heaps on the floor. Chinese A-listers issued statements disavowing Dolce & Gabbana. Arriving at Shanghai's airport, actor Chin Kun reportedly told fans, I'm going back, and boarded a return flight to Beijing. Brand ambassadors Wang Junkai, a singer, and Dilraba Dilmirat, a movie star, terminated their contracts. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon star Zhang Ziyi shared a meme of a cartoon panda force-feeding emoji-shaped shit to two other animals. You dropped your pile of crap. I'm giving it back to you, says the panda. Liu was at home on his sofa, vaping and eating gelato as he posted through it all. He stayed up until 5 or 6 a.m. sharing news, jokes, and commentary about, as he called it, hashtag DG the shit show. When Skylar awoke on Wednesday morning, after sleeping through much of the excitement, she saw videos of people setting fire to Dolce & Gabbana's wares and headlines about Dolce & Gabbana canceling the great show. The designers flew back to Italy, where they filmed and released a video apology. Diet Prada archived its post in an Instagram story labeled at DG the shit show, just another day in the age of social media meltdowns of the rich and powerful. The world moved on, but Dolce & Gabbana didn't. 4 months later, Liu and Skylar received notice that the brand planned to sue them both for defamation. The lawsuit, eventually filed in a civil court in Milan, claims upwards of $665 million in damages, owing to major setbacks the company has faced in the Chinese market, which in 2018 accounted for one-third of the international luxury industry's revenue. It is the first defamation suit the company has ever filed, according to a brand representative. Liu and Skylar are the only people Dolce & Gabbana is suing over fallout from the fiasco in Shanghai. With litigation pending for more than 2 years in Italy's COVID-delayed legal system, Liu and Skylar have lived under this Dolce & Gabbana-designed sword of Damocles, according to Fordham University law professor and Fashion Law Institute director Susan Scafidi, who represents the pair pro bono. It's a kind of David and Goliath legal battle that usually stirs sympathy. The wealthy owners of a famously decadent billion-dollar company are suing two self-employed bloggers for more money than a court ordered Samsung to pay Apple in 2018 for copying the iPhone. But in the years since its hashtag DG the shit show post, Diet Prada has expanded and become so divisive that obvious allies sometimes hesitate to defend Liu and Skylar. Diet Prada, once a niche phenomenon for and by fashion's chattering class, now has 2.8 million followers and is fairly mainstream. Liu calls it a hub for fashion, pop culture, politics, and social justice. Meanwhile, the great show's fate, cancellation, has become a mainstream fear, fixation, and flashpoint. Call and response rituals have developed around Diet Prada's signature genre of discourse, the social media call-out. Apologies, denunciations, backlash, clapbacks, defiant right-wing media tours, explanations of nuance, and promises to do better. Skylar described holding herself accountable as a never-ending process. It's like anti-racism. It's not an act with an end goal. It's an ongoing practice. The process has placed a target on Diet Prada's back, too. As the internet outrage cycle matures, call-outs increasingly draw meta-call-outs. Accusations of hypocrisy, bias, ignorance, bullying, and failures in doing the work. News outlets alternately scrutinize and take cues from players on social media, as do readers, who sound off on their own platforms. As Diet Prada grows, Lou and Skylar have found themselves in a vice. On one side are popular pressures similar to those they harnessed to throw rocks at giants and to gain nearly 3 million followers, fluent in the language of internet backlash. On the other side are power players with deep pockets who squeeze with the customary methods of crushing their enemies, including expensive lawsuits. Like the one in Milan, where a judge is now considering a simple but potentially crippling question. What's Diet Prada got to do with the price of D&G in China? When I began corresponding with Lou and Skylar in March, they had been facing Dolce & Gabbana's lawsuit for 2 years, but had only been talking about it publicly for a couple of weeks. They were polite, circumspect, generous with their time, and extremely careful. In recent years, Diet Prada has granted interviews only in writing. Though they wrote conversationally and with candor, including about their personal lives, I got the feeling that they insisted on email for control or self-protection. I don't entirely know, though, because every time I ask, Lou declined to explain beyond the fact that emails were a policy based on some advice given to us by friends in the industry that, when asked, he also declined to explain. The pair launched Diet Prada anonymously in late 2014 to call out purportedly copycat fashion designs by posting side-by-side runway shows on Instagram. Diet Prada refers to watered-down imitations of the work of Miuccia Prada. The first post juxtaposed a Raf Simons designed Dior coat with an earlier, similar one from Prada. 5 years later, Simons became the co-creative director of Prada. At the time, Lou and Skylar were in their 20s and working as accessories designers for New York milliner Eugenia Kim. Lou interviewed Skylar when she applied for a position, which became her first full-time job. Skylar, who was now 33, had moved to New York from North Florida, where she was born and raised, to pursue fashion. Lou, who is now 36, was born in New York City and raised upstate. He returned to the city after studying art and fashion in Chicago. Diet Prada started as office chit-chat. We would look at runway shows, just kind of shooting the shit, and we would do these live roasts back and forth, sitting in opposite corners, Lou said, when he and Skylar revealed their identities in the business of fashion in 2018. When I look back at our early post, Skylar told me by email in March, I remember how frustrated I was at the industry and the way it felt like originality wasn't just being ignored, it was being stifled by the people that held all the cards at the top. All the attention and reward was being heaped on a handful of people. She felt a sense of injustice when already successful people profited from ideas seemingly plucked from smaller creators and unacknowledged movements. They stirred up the industry, said veteran fashion journalist Christina Binkley, who worked at the Wall Street Journal during Diet Prada's rise. Lou and Skyler skewered legends and documented phenomena usually discussed in whispers, such as cultural appropriation and sexual harassment. By May 2018, Diet Prada had nearly 400,000 followers and was the most feared Instagram account in fashion, according to the Business of Fashion, which now lists the pair in its index of the industry's 500 most influential people. Diet Prada's fans have sometimes included those they criticize. In 2017, the account called out Gucci for seeming to rip off Harlem tailor Dapper Dan, himself a fashion underdog, routinely accused of violating luxury trademarks. The company responded by collaborating with the tailor and helping to rebuild his atelier. Soon after, Gucci invited Lou and Skyler to take over its Instagram account during Milan Fashion Week. They invited us to analyze the collection and spot their references, and we are finding their transparency refreshing, Diet Prada wrote in a hashtag-sponsored post. Later that year, Financial Times writer Lou Stoppard theorized Gucci appeared to be calling a truce. But some might interpret the sponsorship, they will not disclose the fee, as an awkward compromise after Diet Prada arguably savaged the brand and designer Alessandro Michele about Dapper Dan and others. Still, Stoppard wrote, in an industry where advertisers still have a hold over what a fashion writer might publish, Diet Prada throws its accusations around like hand grenades. Today, Lou and Skyler both consider Diet Prada their primary occupation. They have a manager, Estate 5 co-founder and bag snob blogger Tina Chin Craig, and have worked with brands such as Ferragamo and Tommy Hilfiger. They also sell merchandise and premium subscriptions. Lou says that Diet Prada's ethics prevents some collaborations by rejecting fast fashion with its exploitative labor practices and brands that lack diversity. It's tough, though, because it feels like every day a new scandal is coming out about how shitty a company is. There's really not many we can work with, and we're okay with that. By the time Lou's and Skyler's names became known to the public in 2017 at the hands of a rival fashion blogger who subsequently received a takedown notice for infringing Lou's copyright on a selfie, they had already achieved a level of clout that some spend their lifetime chasing. When Diet Prada stormed the gates, fashion's gatekeepers paid attention. Stefano trolled our account fairly hard in the early days, said Skyler. The earliest Diet Prada citation in the Dolce & Gabbana lawsuit dates to 2017, soon after Diet Prada's at Gucci takeover. The post on at Diet Prada showed a Dolce & Gabbana window display that takes a stab at an aesthetic attributed to Gucci. In the comments, at Stefano Gabbana defended himself, Gucci copy us in many different way. This is one of Please Say Sorry to Me. The episode went meta after Diet Prada released hashtag Please Say Sorry to Me t-shirts. Dolce & Gabbana then sold its own, significantly more expensive version. From the outside, those interactions could be seen as playfully adversarial, but the brand's lawsuit describes them as part of a Diet Prada smear campaign that spanned 5 years and reached peak pervasiveness and aggressiveness on the occasion of an important Dolce & Gabbana event and show planned in Shanghai. By the time of the great show, exposing racially insensitive moments in fashion had become part of Diet Prada's stock in trade, but Lou acknowledges that covering the episode was a turning point. I think it was the first time I got to speak out for my own community, he said, of his first post about the Canolo video. Liu's parents, who are Chinese immigrants, lived in New York City's Chinatown when he was born. His mother's first U.S. job was in a garment factory. His father washed dishes at a restaurant. The family later moved upstate to own and operate a Chinese restaurant. As a teenager and during summers home from college, Liu worked as a cashier and delivery person. Growing up as a queer person of color in a predominantly white town, I've often found myself intimidated and at a loss for words when confronted with racism and bigotry, he wrote in March in a statement about the lawsuit. When Diet Prada called out, hashtag DG loves China, he said by email, seeing that people understood why this was problematic made me feel seen and heard. To be honest, it was surprising how fast it reached China and the action that the people took, said Liu. I had never seen anything like it. The screenshots of Gabbana's alleged DMs in particular hit a nerve. Terence Chu, CEO of Apex Group, the production company that staged the event, said he thought they were a joke when he first saw them backstage as they circulated on Weibo. Instagram is blocked in China. Then, models began to field calls from their agents. People were rushing out of there, said Melvin Chua, CEO of the Shanghai-based PR firm that managed the show's guest list. Chua is also my cousin. The backstage looked like somebody ransacked it because people were in the middle of hair and makeup and changing. After the great show's cancellation, some argued that the fiasco would be a wake-up call for international brands. As I have voiced time and again, publicly and privately, Western brands seeking to enter and expand in China should be aware of Chinese cultural sensibilities. Instead of dictating everything from head office, they would gain a lot from listening to the opinions and insights of their Chinese teams, said Angelica Chung, then the editor-in-chief of Chinese Vogue. If you want a bigger slice of the profit pie, then listen to the people, wrote British Chinese fashion blogger Susie Lau on Instagram. China Market Research Group CEO Sean Ryan conducted focus groups about the hashtag DG Loves China videos. Reactions were overwhelmingly negative, he said, due to the sexual overtones and the denigration of Chinese culture. Ryan's company studies Chinese consumers, in part, to advise American financiers on international investments. Chinese are very sensitive to imperialism, explained Ryan, invoking China's century of humiliation under Western rule. Focus groups saw Dolce & Gabbana's interest in China as exploitative. Westerners denigrating China, while taking advantage of its wealth, a phenomenon Ryan linked to the legacy of the Opium Wars. Or, in Diet Prada's words, hashtag DG loves China? More like hashtag DG desperate for that Chinese RMB, LOL. Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana were in Italy when they apologized on video. The Dolce & Gabbana brand itself has largely exploited a certain semantic level over the years. To prove this, the critics list the meanest things Gabbana's Instagram account has posted, including comments calling the Kardashians the most cheap people in the world, taunting body positivity advocates for preferring to be fat and full of cholesterol, and retorting in 2017, to critics of his brand's hashtag DG Loves Naples campaign, I will no longer come to Naples to advertise to you ugly people. You are the disgust of Italy. The defense also argues that Italy is the wrong jurisdiction for the case, since Liu and Skyler posted from New York. It's a beautiful defense, but it's simply not suitable for an Italian court, said Professor Annalisa Ciampi, who teaches international law at the University of Verona and is an attorney at law and ambassador for the European Network for Women Excellence. Italian law does not have forum non conveniens, meaning that Italian judges have less latitude on issues of jurisdiction. Dolce & Gabbana's bank accounts are in Italy, which means most of the alleged damages took place in Italy, and Ciampi thinks that's enough for the case to proceed. Ciampi also believes that the defense invoking Gabbana's worst speech acts could backfire by suggesting that both Diet Prada and its subject lacked restraint. But even if the judge rules in Dolce & Gabbana's favor, the claim for damages is beyond me, said Ciampi, proving a casual link between Lou and Skylar's actions and Dolce & Gabbana's bottom line will be extremely difficult. But Ciampi pointed out that Dolce & Gabbana's lawyers at the white shoe law firm Cleary Gottlieb must know that. They must also know that Lou and Skylar don't have this kind of money. They might just want to make the point, Ciampi speculated, noting that Italian civil judgments are public, which may itself be a form of redress. You get the publication of the judgment, which recognizes that your reputation was offended, so that is going to be some form of reparation, Ciampi explained. The moment they get this judgment, they can translate it in all the languages of the world, and they can post it. Nearly 3 years later, Diet Prada's at DG The Shit Show post remain on Instagram, and Lou and Skylar continue apace with call-outs, LOLs, gossip, and Mucha Prada worship. Describing the last 2 years, Lou said, the lawsuit was absurd then as it is now, but we work so much that there was always enough going on to distract us from the reality of it. The duo's stubborn righteousness also seems to power them. Said Skylar, we were doing what we saw as the right thing and speaking out against racism. So for our business to be threatened in a very real way, for that feels like a direct effect of the supremacist system we are ultimately speaking out against. Or maybe they know what several lawyers told me. Even if an Italian judge rules against Lou and Skylar, any financial penalties will likely be unenforceable. If Lou and Skylar's assets are in the United States, said Ciampi, then enforcing a civil ruling against them would require cooperation from an American judge. Their lawyers could then trot out the same jurisdiction arguments that Ciampi described as too American, and it could work. Professor Linda Silberman, who teaches at NYU School of Law and is the co-director of the Center for Transnational Litigation, Arbitration, and Commercial Law, agreed. If a foreign judgment violates American public policy, an American judge will not enforce it. That includes policies on jurisdiction as well as free speech, including a 2010 law against so-called liberal tourism. Domenico Dolce and Stefano Gabbana denied Vanity Fair's request for interviews, which was not surprising. Though outspoken, the pair tend to be selective about where they demonstrate that trait. After an Italian magazine inadvertently outed them as a couple in the 80s, writes Professor Derek Duncan in Reading and Writing Italian Homosexuality, Dolce and Gabbana came out willingly in interviews with two Italian newspapers in 2000. They said they'd granted one specifically to promote tolerance for homosexuality, but came away with some of their earliest accusations of homophobia for statements rejecting gay marriage and criticizing gay pride celebrations. Thus began a tradition of provocative candor that modern audiences might call problematic. The lawsuit against Diet Prada argues that characterizing Gabbana as homophobic is inaccurate. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones. reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.